Good morning. Here we are. How fortunate. This morning I will finish talking about the first practice instruction of Hongzhe. I gave the first talk on this piece about 2 months ago. It was Easter Sunday. And I talked about the first half of it. And so today I endeavor to finish. We'll see how we do. But for those of you who weren't here on Easter, the explanation, kind of the context for this, is that this piece, which is called The Bright Boundless Field, and it's on the front of your programs, for those of you who have them, is one of the practice instructions of Hongzhe. He was a Chinese Chan, Zen master, who lived in the early 12th century. He had a profound influence on Dogen. Dogen is the Zen teacher who took traditional Chan Zen practice from China to Japan. And he's the founder of our school, Soto. So anything that had a lot of influence on Dogen has a lot of influence on us, kind of. So Hongzhe is kind of one of those voices. And the more familiar you actually become with his stuff, the more you can hear it in Dogen. Dogen lifts from him and borrows from him a lot. So some of his stuff is labeled verses, and some of his stuff is labeled practice instruction. And honestly, I don't speak Chinese, so I can't tell you what the words that were translated as practice instruction were. The piece that we're talking about today is from a book called Cultivating the Empty Field, which was translated by Teigen Leighton. And it's the only translation I'm aware of, anyway. And I'm not sure how much of the specifics of language is Teigen's and how much of it is Hongzhe's. But what's interesting to me is practice instruction certainly sounds like I'm giving you teaching now. I'm instructing you on how to practice now. So it's definitely I'm giving you something we're going to call instruction, right, or teaching. And yet the voice, which you can read and which you'll hear today, it feels so much like an artistic expression. It feels more like a poem to me, or a dance, or something, which is kind of cool. I actually sort of trust that in a way that I might perhaps not trust it if it was very, very left-brained and sort of linear. There's nothing wrong with left-brained and linear, but I like the idea that my starting point with this stuff was practice instruction. And then it was like he did an interpretive dance, and then he was done. And it's sort of like, there it was. That was as clear as I could make it. I think that's pretty cool. So I'm interpreting. This is my interpretation, but it is really like interpreting art more than it is science. So if you missed the first talk, the verse starts. Yeah. The verse starts, the field of boundless emptiness is what exists from the very beginning. You must purify, cure, grind down, or brush away all the tendencies that you have fabricated into apparent habits. Then you can reside in the clear circle of brightness. Utter emptiness has no image. Upright independence does not rely on anything. Just expand and illuminate the original truth, unconcerned by external conditions. Accordingly, we are told that not a single thing exists. In this field, birth and death do not appear. So that's what we talked about last time. And my quick kind of synopsis of that is that that is the proper response. My quick kind of synopsis of that is that the field of boundless emptiness is what exists from the very beginning. That reminded me so much of Dogen's The Way is Originally Perfect and All-Pervading. It feels to me like a really important starting place, in a way. And I guess I don't want to say starting place, because it's really the starting place and the middle place and the end place in Zen. But I love that right out of the gate, the very first thing we hear is about the undividedness of all things, the boundlessness of all things. And when our starting point in practice is that everything is as it should be, without boundary, it changes our relationship to what it is we're doing on the cushion, what it is we're doing for a living, what it is we're doing when we watch our minds, when we relate with our loved ones, right? Most of us, including myself, come to Zen practice, at least at the beginning, thinking something is broken and I want to fix it, right? Which makes sense. And it's true, too, in a sense. In a limited sense, that's very, very true. And if it's what gets you in the door, good. Stick with that. Because if you stick with practice long enough, you'll see through that. Does that make sense? But it's interesting to be told when we come to a meditation center, everything's fine. you're like, well, no, it's not, because that's why I'm here. And then they were told, well, you are Buddha. You are boundless awareness. There's no fault, there's no stain, there's no problem. That's what you are. And we usually think, well, no, I'm not. I'm very clearly not. But it's an interesting starting point. It really does define, in a lot of ways, the Soto Zen relationship with practice. That practice, Zen practice, is an expression of what's pre-existent. It isn't an attempt to change something to get to. Right? So we say this a lot here. You hear it over and over and over. This talk on the last verses of this is going to sound exactly like the first talk on the first verses of this, right? And the talk last week and the talk next week, they're all sort of just variations on the same theme. I think because we need to be reminded. But, so Zen practice is seen in Dogen's eyes, in Hongzhi's eyes, in the eyes of the ancestors as an expression of perfect understanding. It really is an expression of something that's already here. So maybe my dance metaphor actually works. You know, like a dance. When you're doing a dance, it isn't like I'm doing the dance in order to become a dancer. I'm dancing because I am a dancer. Right? You can't separate those two things. Isn't that weird? It's sort of like practicing the guitar to play the guitar. In order to practice, you have to play. Oh, that's interesting. So all they're pointing to is this division we make in our minds between, you know, what it is that we're actually doing, which is cute and stuff, but it's a means to an end. The real thing will arrive soon, hopefully. And there's really no such division. So it is a little closer to art than it is to craft. Zen practice is more a song than a hammer. How about that? I'm done. All right. So, the other thing I mentioned last time in reference to the first seven lines was that is the lovely paradox. And it isn't actually a paradox, but it feels this way to us. Our starting point is everything's perfect. Wow, everything's great. Boundless emptiness. I am Buddha. Wonderful. And so now that I know that, there's a whole bunch of stuff that needs to be done. Oh, but you just said, those appear to be two different things, and they're not. For Hongzhi, for Dogen, the practice, yeah, it isn't a means to an end, it is an expression, and yet that is what you do. You know, you don't sit to become Buddha, you sit because you are. That's what Buddhas do. You don't practice compassion in order to be seen as compassionate. You practice compassion because that's what you are. You can't not do that. Does that make sense? Like you breathe because you breathe. you digest food right now because you're digesting food right now. This is what these beings called humans do. It's our essential nature, our original face. And so in a lot of ways, we are practicing enlightenment in delusion, and we are practicing delusion in enlightenment. Those things become inseparable. And even being aware, wow, am I messed up right now? It's pretty cool to know that. That's kind of clarity, isn't it? That's kind of clarity. Being aware, wow, I'm really messed up right now. Wow. There's some error there. There's some freedom there. It's when we don't think we're messed up that we're in bad shape. Haven't you found that to be true in your lives? You know, usually in retrospect, you look back and go, oh, wow, I really thought I was on the right track with that idea. Wow. So there is a practice, of course, because it is. It's watching the mind. It's doing the practice. We have to practice compassion, and at first it feels like something clunky that's added from the outside. And after a while, it's just a reminder, oh, this is who you are. This is what already is. And it's allowed to arise so much more effortlessly. Awareness clears up, and compassion clears up, and our wisdom is just right there. So his phrases in the beginning were purifying, curing, grinding down, and brush away. And those are work words, right? I mean, they are. That's zazen, that's retreats, that's daily sitting, that's doing it when you don't want to, that's doing it longer than you want to, right? That is the work of practice. Walking the path, watching the mind, working with the seeds, transforming the seeds. And then finally, last time we talked a little bit about his last line from the first section. In this field, birth and death do not appear. So we talked about how birth and death don't exist. I hope you didn't miss that talk because we figured it out. So today, the last half. If you do not have a program, I'll read it aloud before I talk about it. The first two lines. The deep source, transparent down to the bottom, can radiantly shine and can respond unencumbered to each speck of dust without becoming its partner. The subtlety of seeing and hearing transcends mere colors and sounds. We'll start with the deep source. Over the years, I've had lots of ideas in my head about what the deep source is or was. And I think it's important to recognize that those were ideas. Our entryway to a lot of our experience is oftentimes through ideas and concepts. The deep source, transparent down to the bottom. So a lot of times I thought of mind or the deep source or the original nature as being this sort of kind of like formless goo that sort of just takes on the shape of everything. Right, when we talk about, you know, form is emptiness. Emptiness is form. There's no difference between mind and matter. All those things. Oh, then I just sort of imagined that everything was made of the same stuff, like clay. You know, they say, oh, you can turn clay into a pot or to a cup or to a tiger, but it's all clay. So I kind of imagined the deep source as being this sort of, yeah, formless goo. It would just take on whatever. Ooh, the form of Monica. Oh, the form of, you know, podium. The form of talk. But I would encourage you to not make an object of it with your mind. To not make an object of it. It isn't something like outside the universe that acts on the universe. It isn't an object. It isn't not an object. It isn't something that can be faced or turned away from. It's never hidden. It's not as abstract as we're making it here. It's kind of like your life is never hidden. Right? Your life is never hidden. Even when you feel lost or screwed up or you've taken the wrong path or whatever, there it is, your life. It's still 100% revealed. It's 100% your life. Right? It's never obscured. It's just there. The wrong path, right path thing is extra. That's the label we add. The deep source is the field far beyond form and emptiness that we talk about. It's not obscured, it's not hidden, it's not lost, it's not found in that sense either. It's never really defiled. And because our mind spends so much time breaking things down into these categories, the thing that I think I can see, the thing that I'm longing for that I wish I could see, being reminded that this is already functioning perfectly is helpful to us. Our response to this awareness is still to practice. But again, it's almost like going back to that idea of there isn't like this vast, huge system that's broken and it's your job to fix it. If you could hurry, please do. It's more of this functioning, even when you think of it as being broken, off-center, off-kilter, out of balance, whatever, is still functioning. This is in no way obscured, in no way hindered. This is your life, fully functioning, wide awake. And isn't your life, when you look back on the times when you have been grabbed onto something, really attached to something, that worked for a while and then it didn't, and the thing that you wanted that you didn't have or whatever, that sort of feeling of, things aren't working. Didn't your experience still just continue perfectly? Right? There wasn't actually an obstacle there. Right? Functioning, 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 functioning. People said things, you heard them. You felt hunger, you ate. Right? When you were sad, you cried. No obstacles. Right? Your life is transparent down to the very bottom. Here it is, functioning, functioning. There's a verse that's recited traditionally before nuns and monks shave their heads that goes, "The bonds of attachment are hard to release within our past, present, and future actions. Realizing the realm beyond karma is the offering of true compassion." So the deep source, already beyond karma. It's already beyond karma. It's already your mind. It responds already in this moment, unencumbered. Right? So it's me saying a word and you hearing a word. There's no problem there. There's no obscuration there. It's just effortless, instant functioning. So he says, colors and the subtlety of seeing and hearing transcends mere colors and sounds. Colors, sounds, are objects. Right? We have an idea of what a color is. We have an idea of what a sound is. Right? A sound is different than a color. A sound and a color are different than thoughts. Both of those things are different than a baseball game. Right? They're separate. They're separate ideas. But thank goodness our ability to see and our ability to hear is in no way limited by our understanding, our concepts, right, of colors and sounds. Seeing and hearing is just happening beyond our ideas of it all the time. Effortless, right? Effortless. So basically what he's saying here, from my point of view, is please don't let your mind spend a lot of time making an object of your life. Don't let your mind spend a lot of time making an object out of your practice. The deep source, yeah, is what you are, who you are most fundamentally. But it's not a subject, it's not an object. Your life is constantly, always transcending subjects and objects. And your life is functioning beyond all of your ideas, beyond all of your awareness. It is grace beyond all your plans. And it's true, right? Otherwise, we all would have died a long time ago, and that really stupid idea that you had that you convinced were right would have truly shut you down, and it would have been the end. But it wasn't. Here you are. Your life just keeps going, right? Katagiri Roshi said that compassion and wisdom are very quick. So quick that they create no gaps between you and your object. It is very difficult to see compassion because it has no form. When compassion has a form, it is just our idea of compassion. Isn't that great? He's saying the very same thing. We talked about this on Tuesday night. No gap between you and your object. And he talked about, his example was, the example he used was, if you see a baby fall into a well, you are moving to help it way before you have ideas about, well, baby, what compassionate action looks like right now. Wouldn't it be cool if somebody watched me while I did this really compassionate action to save this baby? I mean, all this is, right, extra. You are already moving to do it. So that's all he's saying, is this is your nature. This is the nature of life. Compassionate connection and awareness. So, he says then, the whole affair functions without leaving traces. It mirrors without obscurations. He's sort of saying the same thing. Have you noticed that? Little variations on the same thing over and over. The whole affair functions without leaving traces. It kind of reminds me, like, if you throw a really good party and the whole affair just functions without obscurations. There was just enough salsa and just the cool people came and they all left right on time. No one stuck around. And that's his point of view on the universe. I always kind of envision, in a sense, him sitting, you know, looking out on the landscape, looking out on the interactions at his monastery, looking out on whatever, and just thinking, wow, the whole thing is just functioning. No obscurations. Like, even those two over there fighting over blah, blah, blah. There it is. Wow, the universe is functioning as two people fighting over something. Wow. Here it is, unfolding. There's no trace left. The fight is over. Those guys figure out whatever their trip is. They're done. No residue. Right? And to be a little more careful here, yeah, there's residue. Yeah, there's residue. It's a little... it's a little bit the way we deal with karma in Zen, is that, yeah, it exists, and you know, there's cause and there's effect, and we are, you know, doing what we're doing right now as a result of every single thing we've ever done. We're absolutely positively beholden to that karma. Every single thing we're doing now affects every other thing we're going to do. Yes, that's real. And at the same time, everything is the cause and the effect of everything else. In other words, it's like acknowledging the stuff we can see seems to follow a pattern that is real, and when we work with it, it's helpful. But we also realize I'm kind of looking at the sky through like a toilet paper tube, and I really am only seeing a small part of it. And the scope of what's actually happening here with cause and effect or karma is way bigger than is ever going to fit in 3 pounds of gray matter between my ears. And so at one point, I'm 100% the sum total of every single thing I have thought, eaten, felt, done, people I've known, right? What you're looking at right now is nothing but conditioned consciousness. And at the very same time, born now, 100% fresh, absolutely unstained, completely undefined, right? How could I be defined by those things? So it's a seeming paradox. It's a different way of working with the teaching of karma, but we won't spend much time with that today. So what do we got? Our next line. Very naturally, mind and dharmas emerge and harmonize. Very naturally, mind and dharmas emerge and harmonize. So in Soto Zen practice, there's really, in the end, there's really not much to do. Actually, just live your life. Right? Ted and I were talking about this upstairs. Like, it's kind of stupid. Soto Zen. It's one of the reasons I think I trust it. Don't you think? In the best possible way. And then we agreed that we like the word naive, perhaps better than stupid. Stupid seems a little mean. It feels stupid sometimes. But kind of naive. Tim talks a lot about, oh, stupid, make sure to keep your practice stupid. Please keep it stupid. Keep it simple, is what he's saying. Keep it very, very, very simple. Keep it naive. Keep it fresh. Because there's so much to do. There is so much that we need to do. And it's all within the context of nothing to do. There is so much delusion and greed and hate. And there is so much suffering in us, outside. I mean, every single person knows that. So it's never about denying the reality of that, trying to talk ourselves out of that, trying to reframe it. You know, Hongzhi's not playing some sort of mind trick on us. But we do trust that everything, even the delusion and the greed and the hate and the suffering are arising and passing without trace. They are part of effortless functioning. And it's funny that when our relationship with reality comes from that place, instead of being, I mean, you'd think we'd be entirely passive. There'd be nothing to do. Oh, I see that you're suffering. Whatever. Not my deal. That's just the universe effortlessly functioning. Right? That's way too ooey-gooey. We don't trust that. We know that there's something not right about that. But I also know that when your difficulty moves me to act out of a place of fear, constriction, anxiety, non-acceptance, I'm probably going to do you more harm than good. Because it's about me. It's about me fundamentally saying, nope, universe is out of order, completely unacceptable. I will not see this clearly. I have a specific idea about what's happening. It is completely unacceptable to me, and I have a very specific idea about what's going to make it better right now. Right? Does that make sense? There's such a constriction around that, and we all know what that feeling is like. We spend a lot of time in that feeling. There's a real connection there to compassion, but gee whiz, it sure blurs over quickly, doesn't it, into projection and codependency and attachment and enabling and all sorts of other things. There isn't the wisdom of what he's talking about here, that in order to be of benefit, deep and lasting benefit, actions, words, lifestyles, practice comes from a place of radical acceptance, real spacious awareness. Wow, here it is, coming up again. Oh, in the form of suffering. Oh, my heart is breaking too. My heart is your heart. Wow, perhaps we can work together. Perhaps there's something we can do to transform this, you know. No, I'm not acting out of fear. I'm not acting out of anxiety. I'm not caught by the narrative. Very naturally, things are functioning. He says mind and dharmas emerge and harmonize, and mind is mind. Dharmas means, it's a small d, dharma. So in this context, dharma means particular elements in the field of reality. That's a pretty lofty phrase, particular elements in the field of reality. That's what Tigan described. I looked at his footnotes. I would have said individual moments of experience, it's the same thing. Contents of consciousness, we could say. But a dharma is an individual moment, an individual element. So he's saying mind, that which beholds consciousness and the contents, very naturally arising simultaneously and harmonizing. So it is kind of like, I say something, you hear it. All right, the bird calls, you feel something. Things are occurring. And we don't have to struggle to make any of that work. You don't have to try. Do you? It's just functioning. Here it is. Emerge in harmony. Emerge and harmonize. And I think harmony is the key concept there. It's a key concept in Mahayana Buddhism that things function. We are putting ourselves in accord with the functioning of things. It's kind of a Taoist ideal, it feels like to me. I don't know. But this is in contrast to that worldview that things are fundamentally broken and separate from us. We are the functioning. We are part of the functioning. And how we find peace and stability, spiritual stability, is our ability to be in harmony with the way things are. And that starts with just awareness and acceptance. Wanting things to be exactly as they are, not needing them to be different. And again, my little footnote here is that mind and dharmas are talked about as two different things here, because he's trying to elucidate a point, but they're really not two different things. They are and they aren't. It's one of those deals. Yes, they're two, but they're not two. They're the same thing. They arise simultaneously. So we can't separate mind from dharmas from the moments in which they arise. That's just one functioning. All right, our next lines. An ancient said that non-mind embodies and fulfills the way of non-mind. Embodying the way of non-mind, finally you can rest. An ancient, Tigan capitalized ancient, which I kind of like, actually, because my understanding is that for people of Japanese or Chinese origin at that time, saying the way it has always been done, or an ancient, or the ancient way, was a way of saying back when they knew what they were doing. back when everything was, you know, that's just a way of saying, like, wow, they really had it, and we sort of lost it, was sort of the worldview. We tend to actually think the opposite now, like, boy, back in the 50s, man, were they a mess. We've really got our act together now. We tend to think the opposite, like, we're sort of steadily improving. They had kind of the opposite, like, no, they really used to do it well, and now we're sort of cobbling it together the best we can. So he's just saying, spiritual authority. An ancient said, non-mind embodies and fulfills the way of non-mind. Embodying the way of non-mind, finally you can rest. Well, what I'm going to do this morning with non-mind is go back to that idea of essential boundlessness, non-separation of thought consciousness. For those of you who are familiar with Fukan Zazengi, the traditional Zazen instruction from Dogen, he says, think not thinking, or think non-thinking. How do you do that? Non-thinking. That's his term, which isn't his term. That's an English word. I don't know what his term was. I have no idea. It actually kind of works. I know English is a very dualistic language, but it kind of works because he's sort of saying, like, Zazen isn't thinking, like sitting and indulging in thoughts, but it's also not thinking, like somehow the bell goes off and you have no thoughts arise until Paul rings the bell again. Oh, wow, that's successful Zazen. Good luck. No, Dogen says non-thinking, as if he's pointing to something that includes both thinking and not thinking, right? Includes both. Transcends both. I sometimes think of it as non-engagement. Just there it is arising, there it is passing. There's the feeling, there it is passing. There's the sound, there it is passing. Non-mind embodies and fulfills. It is self-fulfilling activity. That's a phrase you hear a lot in Zen. Something that is complete in and of itself. Making tea can be an activity that is just self-fulfilling. Every bit of you is involved in making tea. There's nothing left over. There's nothing lacking. You're not doing it as a way to get to something or get away from something. It is self-fulfilling. So this is Zazen. Whether you're aware of that or not, it is self-fulfilling. Actually, every moment of experience, you always are there, but there's that sense of the thing that's arising, the thing you're participating in, is the thing itself. It is whole and complete and perfect. It fulfills. I love the word fulfills. There's an emotional feeling there I like. And he says, embodying this way, embodying the way of non-mind, finally you can rest. Isn't that nice? That's nice for me. Finally you can rest. There's a sense there that I really agree with. When he says, finally you can rest, it's almost like what he's saying is, you realize you're running all the time, right? Wouldn't it be nice if you could just finally rest? Again, I know some of these words are Taigen's because he's working with Chinese, but finally you can rest. That's kind of, I'm sure, in some way or other, why you came here. That's why I came here. I wanted the thing called enlightenment, but it was basically, I just want to rest. I don't want to suffer. I don't want to be caught. I don't want to, right? I just want to rest. I want this moment to be full. I want it to be enough. I want to stop running. I want to stop chasing. I want to, right? I think there is that sense. So many of us have on some level, and for a lot of us, it's subconscious, but that is a hamster wheel. I just got to keep going because whatever it is that would catch up with me if I stopped is too horrible to think about. Or the thing that I'm sure I'll catch up with to someday is so fabulous that the whole thing, it has a momentum, doesn't it? Our lives, I mean, it's the calendar or it's the emails or it's the whatever that sense, like, God, I've been sitting here for an hour and a half. I wonder how many are in my inbox right now. You know, and then inbox, you're like, God, I'm scared of half of them. I don't want half of them. But the other half are really cool. Oh, God, I'm not even sure how to feel about that. Does that make sense? I mean, there's this sort of subtle anxiety about just day-to-day existence. And sometimes it's very pointed and it's not subtle. You're very aware, oh my God, I'm running. And if it's a bear, please do. Please do. No. That's right. You're not supposed to run if it's a bear. You bang a pan. So, if it's a bear, please bang a pan. If it's a black bear. See, you never know what you're going to get when you come here. This other stuff has been lofty and trippy, but this is practical advice. Anyway, this is my favorite line, actually. My favorite line of this whole piece is, finally you can rest. Finally you can rest. This is, the way I look at this, the way I've experienced this, is the fruits of practice. It's the promise of practice. It's also practice. It's the place we want to get to. Finally, I can rest. Won't that be nice? But it's also what you just did in this room from 9:10 until 9:50. You rested. Right? Even if it was very, very busy, head, even if it was churning heart, even if it was anger or sadness, anxiety, you rested in it, didn't you? You just saw it. There it was. There it was. You opened your hand one more time and allowed it to be there. I see you. There it is. Right? Right? You weren't feeding it. You weren't running away from it. You just allow it. Wow. Isn't that interesting? His rest, his promise, his non-mind doesn't come after, and when all these things line up just right, you'll have a great experience and everything will be groovy. He really is just saying, here it is. The field of boundless emptiness is what exists from the very beginning. You don't have to create it. You can't run from it. It's right here. It's what you are. You can rest. You can rest. It's a wonderful counterpoint to how much he talks about awareness. Awareness and alertness. Because we usually think of, I go back to this a lot, and I always have to put my hands out. Why do I do that? Because it's a scale, that's what, because it's a scale. So on one hand, as humans, we have this thing that's sleep. That's really deep relaxation. All the lights are off. I am asleep. I'm completely relaxed, right? And then the other half, we have this sort of, I am being chased by a bear. Right? Full alert. If you've ever been, I always think of car accident because I've been in one car accident in my life, and I remember those 8 seconds with unbelievable clarity. Colors, sounds, tastes, like every single thing about me was wide awake. But it was the furthest thing from relaxed. Right? I would not want to live being aware in that way. In fact, I couldn't. Physiologically, I couldn't stand to be it because I was so tense, right? And Zazen is this fabulous invitation to, why don't you do both? Why don't you be 100% present? All of your faculties. Be aware of everything. What you taste, what you smell, what you hear, how you feel in your body, memories, thoughts. Oh yeah, there it is. Include all of it. Be all that awake. At the same time, completely relaxed. Right? You don't have to engage with any of it. You don't have to run from it. You can actually sit upright in a posture of stability and solidity and just be right in it. Wow. That's pretty cool, right? It really is balancing these two things. And we know from being on the cushion what it feels like when we start getting a little too, I don't know what, tense. Not relaxed enough because our posture gets tense. We engage muscles we don't need to engage. Things start to hurt. We feed the emotional cycle. We feed the drama. We add to the story, right? And we know what it feels like the opposite, right? Which is, I really was daydreaming there for about 20 minutes. In fact, I think that was dreaming. All right, I admit, I was snoring. And when Paul hit the dinger there, and I woke up. Wow. Oh, you were relaxed. Right? It's this kind of balancing act. This kind of balancing act. And that's why I think the finally you can rest is so important, because he's talking so much about awareness, absolute clarity, constant functioning, this perfect thing that's happening all the time. And you almost feel like, oh, God, I got to catch it. I got to get all of it. I can't let anything go by without missing it. He's like, no, the response and the results of all this is relax. You can rest. Finally, you can rest. finally, you can rest to me means effort without desire. Maybe that's another way of talking about this balancing act. It's effort, right? There's work to be done, but there's no desire in it. Effort doesn't come from a place of non-acceptance, right? Effort without desire. And in my experience, effort without desire isn't really effort. It feels like rest. You know how they say, like, when you're when you're a kid and you're playing out in the yard all day long, and you come in, you're exhausted. Like, yeah, that was effort. I mean, your body is tired, whatever. And yet, do you know what I mean? You don't feel tired the way we do as adults when you just feel like, I got nothing left. You don't feel that way when you're a kid and you're done playing. You're somehow even more awake. I don't know. Right? Well, yeah, you must be, or else your parents wouldn't have such a hard time getting you to go to sleep at night. Yeah, effort without desire is rest. So this is practice that isn't motivated by that grasping or that fear, the thing we want that's in front of us or the thing that we feel like is chasing us. So there's a neat story I found. And I can't credit anybody because I'm afraid there was nobody credited as writing this. An angel was walking down the street carrying a torch in one hand and a pail of water in the other. A woman approached the angel and asked, "What are you going to do with the torch and the pail?" The angel said, "With the torch, I'm going to burn down all the mansions of heaven. And with the pail, I'm going to put out all the fires of hell. Then we will see who really loves God." So that's a cool story, I think. And it reminded me how many of us are motivated in our spiritual practice by our desire for reward or our fear of suffering. You know, it's almost universal. So when you notice that in yourself, not a problem. Please don't judge it. Then you're just lighting a little fire in hell. Please don't, right? But isn't that interesting? How much of it is, what am I going to get? What am I going to avoid? Right? What am I moving toward? What am I moving away from? And one of my very favorite definitions in English translations of the Buddhist word dukkha, from the First Noble Truth, one of my favorite definitions is struggle. It's usually translated as suffering, dissatisfaction, which certainly works. Struggle, I like. I like the term struggle there. Because when we struggle with reality, when we struggle with what is, whether out of fear or out of grasping desire, we suffer. And we see this in our lives all the time. So the practice really is rest. It really is just resting. Proceeding, you are able to guide the assembly. Well, proceeding is just constant practice. That's all it is, the circle of the way. Life proceeding, life flowing. Guiding the assembly, I saw as our joy as bodhisattvas, our obligation, but our joy as bodhisattvas, to be of service, to help, to guide. And that can be something very obvious that looks like guiding, or it can be something very subtle. But it's almost like, well, now that you've rested, now that you have clarity, now that you have some peace in your heart, you can move forward and help, right? You can move forward and help. That's why we do this. With thoughts clear, sitting silently, wander into the center of the circle of wonder. If there was any one line from this thing you wanted to print out and put above your zafu in your house, this would be the one. Thoughts clear, sitting silently, wander into the center of the circle of wonder. It's a beautifully poetic line. The center of the circle of wonder. And this is just kind of what I started off with today. I do think this practice makes you beautifully and wonderfully fresh. And we could say naive, or we could say simple, we could even say stupid if we felt funny. But the center of the circle of wonder is what you are. It is where we live. And it's a way of describing that state of sort of sustained susceptibility to experience that we get when we practice a lot. We're like, wow, this spot on the carpet is really warm because it's in the sun. And the spot next to it is cold because it's not in the sun. And I can step back and forth. And it's warm, cool, warm, cool. That's pretty neat. I don't know. Is there something more? I don't know. Please, let's be that susceptible. Let's be that available to our experience. Let's be that that full of wonder, right? Full of wonder. That's just zazen. Wonder and his word wander are an interesting counterpose. Wander is zazen, practice, goalless movement, effort without desire. And wonder is too. Isn't that nice? So the last line, this is how you must penetrate and study. And this is a lovely summation of what he's talked about. Penetrate and study, to me, feel like this idea of ongoing exploration. Dogen might have said investigation. It's a reminder that our type of study here isn't getting it. It isn't related to conventional understanding, but it's a circle. A circle. It's a way of being Zen practices. So again, it's like art. It's much, much closer to art. It is complete in every moment, an expression of what is. So to wrap up, I will thank you for being here, and I'll remind us that this piece, all of the works of Hongzhi are beautiful. I encourage you to read them. He's got, I don't know, 50 pages maybe worth of writing that's come to us. And he's one of our more revered Zen ancestors, but I'll just remind you that the path of the ancestors, that ancient thing that we tend to think about as being the pure lofty ideal, is your practice. Please remember that. It is your Zazen, right? Your Zazen is Hongzhi's Zazen. It is the circle of wonder. It is the Buddha's Zazen. This is what's coming alive right now, right? It is what's there from the very beginning. It is what is the field of boundless emptiness. We are being supported by all beings. We are supporting all beings. It can't be otherwise. It really can't be otherwise. So please sit just as you are. When you sit with what is, with the stuff of your life, you are completely penetrating and studying all life. And there's a beautiful freedom there, and you're being of enormous service. So very peaceful. Very peaceful. Right? Very beautiful. And that's all I have this morning, so thank you.